Office is certainly not dead. Office is going to continue to evolve, but it's really going to be focused on what the experience is. It's never going to go back to Office as just a box.
Hi, I'm Gordon Lamphere, and welcome to the Real Finds Podcast, the podcast that interviews key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers who are shaping commercial real estate and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we'll be speaking with Spencer Levine. Spencer is president of Rawl Companies, a New York-based developer of residential, resort, and office properties. On the podcast, we discuss Spencer's passion for design and building workspaces that raise the bar for consumers and landlords alike. We dive into the specifics about improving the built environment, including the importance of amenities, floor plan diversity, and vertical circulation in attracting tenants. And we wrap up the podcast by comparing office development methods that work nationally and how buildings in New York, Miami, and many other metro areas that Spencer's developed can continue to lease up despite headwinds. Look, if you're interested in office and making money in this difficult environment, this podcast is a must listen. Spencer, thanks for hopping on the podcast today.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
So why real estate?
I grew up in the real estate world. I am the son of an architect, grew up on a construction site, have always loved the built environment. I grew up every weekend we spent on job sites, at projects, learning what we were doing. It's a family 44-year-old family-owned and operated business that we're now running here. And so there wasn't much of a difference between family life and home life and work life. It was always, we were always part of it. And my father made an effort to make sure that we were always part of it. And growing up in it, I have this passion for delivering spaces that people get to experience and react to. And that's actually how I became a licensed landscape architect originally. My degrees are both in landscape architecture, and it was the perfect hybrid between the built environment and nature, which I've always enjoyed, the environment and being outside and experiencing what the world has for me.
Why do you think the built environment is so important?
I think both the natural and the built environment play such a role in our everyday experiences. I think the opportunity for every person to experience the built environment differently. I know from my experience, one of the things that I love working on most, and I've told this story often, is that I love working on hotel and hospitality projects and office projects as well, where you have this transient population that's using it. So every person that comes into that space is this unique impression and this unique reaction to the space. So you get this almost immediate joy and kind of, or not joy, but you kind of get this immediate...
A visceral reaction.
The people get the visceral reaction, and you as the designer or as the developer or as the facilitator of that built environment get the opportunity to see how people react to it. I think my career, my understanding of the built environment has only grown as I've gotten to experience more of these reactions and more of these delivery experiences and how someone, when someone walks into a lobby of a great office building, how they react to it, how people arrive, what that overall experience of the built environment is. My education goes back to the larger scale. With landscape architecture, I really focused on the urban planning scale too. So seeing how, as you work on a project, like we'll talk about Zero Irving and our experiences here in Manhattan, but as you work on a project that's so site specific, how that building fits into the larger context and how a project that is just a site in a neighborhood, that neighborhood is impacted by that project, and how that then the impact of that project on that neighborhood impacts the larger region, and this kind of scaling effect. And you really get to see how that that domino effect happens.
And so speaking of domino effects, one of the big domino effects has been in the post-2020 world. We've seen domino effects across the office space market. I'm curious, you guys have been generally pretty successful at leasing in the post-2020 market. What are you seeing in the 2024 to 2025 office market?
So we're seeing that officing is not just about creating a box anymore. We're drawing a lot of experience. And what's interesting is we saw a trend in office development or a trend in how officing was changing prior to the COVID, in a pre-COVID world even, that the way that people were coming to work, working, it was starting to change even before it was forced to change. So what we're seeing is that we're drawing experiences and our experience from luxury residential work. Hospitality has, having people in a building, having to keep their attention and draw people to that building, making these environments somewhere where people want to be and are productive. A lot of these experiences from the hospitality world are coming into this. And what we're seeing is that.
And so what are those experiences? Because like what draws people to a building?
Yeah. And I think what we're seeing is that it's as much about the services or the spaces that you're providing as it is to the actual space of the tenant. So when we look at a project like Zero Irving and other office projects like the Link project that we're going to be delivering in Wynwood in Miami, you see that it is about providing spaces that are flexible, that can adapt to how companies grow, to providing a diversity of floor plates, spaces that are well thought out from an engineering standpoint, whether it be column grid, a light and air, MEP systems, really making sure that you've got these well thought out systems that are supporting the space, but also going to the amenity level. It's not just about throwing money at a project and throwing every amenity you can possibly fathom at a project. It's about finding those amenities that really do have a return on that investment. So in our buildings, we've been putting gyms in our buildings for years, but it's not just about putting the largest gym. It's about putting a gym with the right equipment and experiences that people are using right now, given the current trends in fitness, health, and wellness into that building, that it could be a 1500 square foot gym, but it's really meaningful to the people who use it. And it gets used. It's not just a big open void. We've for years really, and this might tie back to my background in landscape architecture, but I believe that there is a real relevant role for outdoor space and experiencing and being able to work in the outdoor environment that really benefits the overall work environment and how it increases productivity. It gives people an opportunity to kind of break the rhythm and find a different kind of space. And at Zero Irving, we have an amazing roof deck that has these views both north and south that are really unique views. But we've also created spaces in that outdoor environment that foster a conversation of two people or can host a company-wide gathering where, you know, you get the real pep talk or you have a cocktail hour or whatever on the roof. So it's that diversity of experiences, the return on those amenities, making sure that you're really choosing the amenities that make a difference in the day-to-day life of the tenants and the employees.
So I'm going to dig back on amenities, but I thought one of the important things that you mentioned, which is something that I've gone over and over with some of the developers we work with, as well as some of the tenants that I worked with when evaluating a building, is diverse floor plans. Can you explain to somebody who might not understand why floor plans are so important in terms of the built space, and floor plan diversity is an important factor that sometimes overlooked?
Absolutely. And it's really one of our the initial analyses that happen when we're looking at a potential development opportunity. And really the importance of being able to support companies that are in different stages of growth, as well as really that flexibility factor is so important in attracting good tenants to a development. And I think where this really plays a role, again, different companies have different requirements, and you want a diversity of tenants in your building. You don't want, while it's nice to be able to lease up the building to 100% with one tenant that's going to take all your floors, the reality is some diversity along the leasing schedule, and really in the industries that are represented in the building is really good, because it really does create a more diverse experience for those other tenants. Smaller floor plates will support. You can get a tremendous amount of bang for your buck on the smaller floor plates that'll support younger stage companies. We've even done things where we've taken some of these smaller floor plates or more achievable floor plates, and we've worked on different structures for how those leases are set up with the tenants. Smaller, potentially there's less of a security deposit or the term is different to really support those early stage companies. Whereas the larger footprints are, really beneficial for larger later stage companies. What we're also finding though, and where the diversity of floor plates really plays a role, is that even the largest of companies, you look at some of the largest tech companies, These companies have massive floor plates. They have massive portfolios of office space. But when you look at how they're now operating their companies, they're actually operating their companies almost like small sub companies or groups within the larger envelope. And what we're seeing is that those large companies want the flexibility of being able to subdivide their spaces into these smaller operating groups. And those smaller operating groups have their own they have their own security, they have their own servers, they have their own, they basically are operating as a standalone entity, but under the larger umbrella. So again, that diversity of floor plates provides that, and the flexibility of the floor plate. And that comes into column grid, it comes into mechanical systems, how you're setting up those buildings. Column free space is wonderful. It gives you the ability to put walls or not put walls wherever you need them. But even if you're moving into a building that does have a regular column grid, knowing how that works to kind of subdivide these buildings and provide for these different opportunities. Often, because we're kind of we are fully integrated, vertically integrated real estate services company, we actually started as an architectural firm 45 years ago. And what we do early on is we'll do full feasibility and kind of fit studies for any building that we're getting into and look at how users might use those floor plates or how they might get divided or how they can rationally be divided. And we'll do that early on so that we know getting into it, we can answer the questions that might come from the tenants. Because again, flexibility, no one knows how, especially in our current environment, no one knows how businesses are going to grow or contract or, what way markets are going. So having that infinite flexibility in those floor plates and the diversity of tenant pool and the diversity of experiences, we find is very important to the success of a building. At Zero Irving, we ranged from a 15,000 square foot floor plate down to a 10,000 square foot floor plate. And that happens in three separate setbacks in the building. So we're able to have consistency, but variety.
So in terms of consistency and variety, there's a number of things that people are consistently talking about. And they're talking about the variety of amenities that are going to attract top talent. Top talent could be in the form on the landlord side of great tenants and on the business side in terms of great employees. And so what are you seeing that your Class A tenant is looking for in terms of amenities and the amenities for?
And the amenities go beyond what are the building-wide amenities. I think the amenities can also be part of what the development is. So it, for instance, access to light and air and access to natural light is a huge amenity that we don't think of as an amenity, but it's something that has to be very well thought out in the initial development of any building, and or reuse or adaptive reuse of any building. But so light is a big amenity that we are seeing. We're seeing the overall experience in the building. So everything from what is the arrival experience into the building, what is the service level at the lobby, elevators and vertical circulation has become a real question that's being asked by tenants. And it's important. I mean, we even chose our office space in a post-COVID environment when we moved from our old office because of the vertical circulation in the building that we're in now. So that's something that plays a role. We're also
And can you explain that for somebody who is a tenant or a potential tenant who might be listening? Can you explain vertical circulation?
Absolutely. So elevator access to your floor and how, we came from a building that was a loft style building in Soho. We loved it there. It was great being in that loft environment. It's very much goes to the heart of what REL is about, a high design environment. But it had a single elevator that was servicing 8 floors, and it was a very small elevator. And, COVID hit, and the idea of being shoved into a 4x4 box with potentially 6 or 8 other people, and also waiting, there was a very high traffic tenant that was higher up in the building than we were. So you were limited in your access to your office by the other tenants in the building because there was a single elevator and it really wasn't a high capacity one. Moved to a building that we have access to 4 elevators that are high speed destination dispatch. It changes the whole experience. Yeah, it makes it a little bit more corporate. It feels like you're arriving in an office building. Our space speaks to our design language, which is great, but it makes it so that we often host large meetings for our projects where we bring all the consultants together. The participants can get in and out easily. It doesn't become part of the, it's not a hassle to experience our office. And I think that is definitely relevant in a lot of the conversations that we're having with tenants and with users of our buildings, where it extends to, it comes up a lot in hospitality and also in branded residential and luxury residential condos. It's how long are you willing to wait to get to your apartment? How long are you willing to wait to leave your apartment? How long are you willing to wait to get to someone's office or to get to your own office? It plays into the overall experience of the building. The other thing that goes along with that is access control and how the elevators are set up. And we're seeing in this tech-based environment, people want a seamless tech-based approach to access control. They want access control because a lot of these the tenants, even your, in your B+ or even C+, we talk about flight to quality a lot. There's a flight to quality within every division of the office world.
Yeah.
And, the prior B- tenant is stretching now to get into a B+ building, and that's like an A+ building to them. And it's a much better experience. But access control is important. You want to feel safe in your space. You want to feel like you have full control of your space. So that seamless access control process has become a very big amenity and a big part of our planning in every project that we do. We learned a lot about that at Zero Irving, and we're bringing that knowledge and technology to Link and Wynwood because it is such an important amenity as part of the overall experience. The elevator setup also, I briefly mentioned as part of the access control system in taller buildings and even in just in larger footprint buildings, destination dispatch is a big amenity in question as well, which is the elevator systems where you put the number in on the keypad while you're waiting for the elevator and the elevator just takes you there. Takes some getting used to from an experience standpoint, but it is really efficient. And again, goes to shorten that wait time and streamline that experience of accessing someone's office.
Yeah. I think one of the most important things that you just talked about was that
everything is relative in terms of the flight to quality. I know I worked with a tenant that essentially is running a call center, and they're moving from what I would almost qualify as D space. I mean, it was terrible, into, you know, what would be maybe B minus space. And for them, they felt like they were entering the Taj Mahal. That's the world that we're in. The human experience is relative, just like the corporate world. One of the things, though, that I think is really interesting is relative to all your competition. You've been very successful at leasing Zero Irving. And I wanted to know, you know, for somebody who might be sitting out there as either a developer or on the user end, what was the real concept behind it? Because I think there are very few people that were sitting back recently and saying, hey, I'm going to develop and build and lease a successful office space. What's the concept behind it?
Yeah, and I appreciate that. We have for a long time really focused on public-private development. We believe that there are some great properties that are owned by local, regional, federal governments that could be repurposed or could become something great that could benefit both the public as well as private. In the case of Zero Irving, we felt strongly that we could deliver a project that did both well and good at the same time. And we started really from the ground. It was an RFP back in late 2015 that we responded to and worked through the process in early 2016. And it was kind of this amorphous, very grandiose idea of creating something that would benefit 21st century jobs. And they kind of left it very open. And we very quickly put together a team that were the best in class at delivering these a comprehensive public-private development, where we could develop the concept. The underlying concept was to develop a vertically integrated ecosystem where every use in that building was highly programmed in a way that it would benefit the other uses in the building. So starting at the ground level, we have a food hall that goes to activate the general neighborhood. I spoke about early on the impact of a single site on a neighborhood and then that impact on the region. The location of Zero Irving on 14th Street between 3rd and 4th Avenue at the terminus of Irving Place was this kind of awkward stretch of 14th Street between those two pretty active, you had Union Square to the west and 3rd Avenue to the east. And those were two very active thoroughfares, but this stretch was kind of weird. So first thing was to activate and really, really change what the urban experience was along the sidewalk there. And we did that with the food hall. We did that with creating this node of activity where all of these uses in the building came together at a single point, which is where Irving Place dead ends into the building, which is hence the name Zero Irving. It is the starting point of Irving Place, Zero. And we created this hub of activity through locating the entrance to the food hall, locating the entrance to what is now the Civic Hall, digital skills and workforce development building within the building, and then the main entrance, the main lobby to Zero Irving. So as you work up the building, we have the food hall. We wanted to deliver something in the building that delivered on this promise of being a support system for 21st century jobs. And what we learned throughout the process is every industry is a tech industry now. You can tack tech on the end of anything. There's construction tech, there's fintech, financial tech. Everything is tech. So what made most sense to us is to develop with a great partner, a center for basically a center for excellence of this digital skills training and workforce development, a place where people can come to gain these skills that then prepare them to advance in the world. In since the entire economy is based on technology now, we did this with Civic Hall, and Civic Hall is part of FedCap companies. And FedCap's been a great partner throughout this. And within that block, what we've discovered is there are digital skills training providers across New York City, but often they're relegated to the outer boroughs, as far away from the center of the city. But that's not where the people who need it most are working or living. So, but they couldn't afford to be in the center of the city in a place like Union Square. So what Civic Hall was able to do was to bring together these best-in-class training opportunities into a single facility where they're licensing space instead of leasing space from Civic Hall and from FedCap. And they're sharing technology, they're sharing equipment, they're sharing the actual improvements to the space, the classrooms, and they're sharing pedagogy. And this hasn't happened before. And it allows these companies or these organizations that are typically forced to the outer boroughs because of cost of all these things to come into the center because they're now sharing the burden of those costs and able to deploy their programs. So Civic Hall has partnerships with LaGuardia Community College and a host of other programs that are now hosting their educational, their pedagogy, their certification programs in Zero Irving. What this does is it actually provides a pipeline of skilled professionals into the remainder of the building. So we envisioned from the start, and it sounded utopic at the time, but it's cool to see these things actually happen. We envisioned the Class A tenants up above actually hiring from this dedicated pipeline of trained individuals. And we're seeing that as Civic Hall defines their programming, you know, focusing on cybersecurity or focusing on a certain kind of AI data analytics, these people are being trained specifically for the jobs that are required upstairs, for those support jobs. So we've had several tenants up above, which happens from floors 8 through 21 in that Class A office block. Those tenants are hiring from Civic Hall, and it's actually the ecosystem's actually working, and everyone's benefiting from each other's existence, which is really cool. So, you know, you asked how we were successful. We were forward thinking in our overall planning. Obviously, no one thought COVID was a thing in 2016, 2017, when we were going through the rezoning, the ULURP process here in New York. But we've always prided ourselves in being very focused on the design and the engineering of a space and providing for that long-term, timeless flexibility, both in engineering and design. So we made decisions at the time, and I like to think that they were just really well thought out. Some might call some of them luck, but you know, we had a touchless experience to get into the building pre-COVID. We had, you know, touchless revolving doors. We had a digitally integrated and touchless turnstile system at Zero Irving. We had destination dispatch that could be controlled from, again, this touchless turnstile system. So we had these things that, you know, when people were looking for space in the 21, 22 time range, when COVID was still very much on our head, and they knew they were looking for spaces that they didn't have to touch and they didn't have to risk, you know, they didn't have that risk in there. We were providing that. We also made decisions, again, because of flexibility and because we knew that the officing world was evolving and that the traditional work hours were not necessarily 9 to 5 anymore. And when you lease an office, you're reading through that lease and you always get to that part about the extra hours, the overtime hours on the MEP system. We didn't want our tenants to get to that part and struggle and didn't want to have those discussions. We want people to work when they want to work. We want people to have access and comfortable access to their offices when they're feeling creative or when they want to actually produce. So at that time, we made the decision to go to a floor-by-floor VRF system with no mixing of anyone's air. And it turned out to be this brilliant decision because of this post-COVID environment where people didn't want to deal with other people's, you know, MEP systems or the mixing of air and the mixing of water. We did it because we felt that the flexibility and being able to occupy your own space was important, but it turned out to serve also the purpose of being really something that was beneficial in a post-COVID world. We talked about the outdoor space and the amenities. I think all of these things really just created a package, including the food hall, including the digital skills training center, and including all the amenities and systems that we designed into it that provided for the perfect post-COVID solution. you know, I'd be lying if I didn't say that during COVID, and we were building throughout COVID, and it wasn't, you know, certainly they were not all restful nights. We all struggled with what was officing going to be. Are we making the right decision? Should we be pivoting? Like, what are we doing here? No one knows if they're ever going back to an office again. We were building a food hall in a time when no one knew if anyone wanted to eat next to anyone ever again. But the reality is we felt the conviction. We knew that the product that we were delivering was so far superior to what the bar was, that if we just got out there to the right people and made sure that we were presenting the product and the program in the right way, that people would understand what we were trying to deliver. And this flight to quality was certainly apparent.
So talking about the right people and trying to get in front of the right people, one of the big things I hear from developers in general is, how do you get in front of the right people in the economic development world and the municipal world? And how do you develop that public-private partnership? Because that's something that we routinely hear as a major industry struggle.
Yeah. You know, I think we are very fortunate to have built the reputation that we have built over the last 45 years. We have never retreated a deal. We have always delivered on time and on budget for our partners, for our municipal partners, for governments around the country, and for ourselves. And reputation plays a really large role in how these public-private developments happen. We talk a big game, but we also act a big game, and we deliver. And it's something, you know, it may be the fact that we are a family-owned and operated company, and that our name is on the line, and our reputation is very important to us. So I think that, you know, that finding the right opportunities that are out there as public-private developments. This was an RFP, a highly publicized one. Some of the biggest developers in New York City pursued this project. Putting together the right program for these public-private developments. I mentioned the idea of doing well and good on a project. And that's something that it took me a long time to figure out the words for it. And only recently have I probably coined that from someone. But it's very important to us that our projects don't just do well, but they also deliver something that's beyond just the monetary returns of that project. If you look at, you know, Zero Irving's a perfect example where we delivered this full ecosystem. We've got the digital skills training. You know, you look at even our project at Pier 6 in Brooklyn Bridge Park, Quay Tower, which we recently hit 90. I think we're over 90% sold on the condos now. It was accompanied also by The Landing, which was, or still is, a mixed income housing that we actually subsidized with the construction of the condominiums. And we were able to deliver at the time, it was actually a reverse 70-30. It was 70% affordable and 30% market rate. We delivered it in a package that no one would ever know was an affordable building, because we believe in high design and making the right design decisions, not throwing money at them, just having very thoughtful design. And that's apparent in all of our project types. And we delivered that, you know, very successful mixed income housing to support that was subsidized by the condo, delivered these two buildings as a single project that delivered much needed affordable housing, especially in Brooklyn Heights on the waterfront, that had never been done before, but also did well as a luxury condominium next to it. So, and being able to deliver on that. And that was something that's another project that we really, you know, we put our cards on the table and really worked to deliver that in an environment that, you know, was, it had to support all the payments from that project had to go to support Brooklyn Bridge Park because it couldn't draw from the general fund. So we were looking for how do we pull all these different levers to deliver something that has that public benefit. It has a really good program, a program that goes to deliver good and also does well in a financial sense to obviously, you know, make money, satisfy our partners and satisfy our lenders. And I think that's really creativity, the creativity that goes into putting together that program, putting together that business plan for these public-private developments, really, I think, is a major tool in successfully getting the projects and then successfully executing the projects. We've had other projects where we've actually reversed into a public-private partnership. One Brooklyn Bridge Park, 360 Furman Street, we bought that building on the open market in 2005 and actually contributed it back to Brooklyn Bridge Park. And we were able to contribute it back for ongoing ground lease and pilot payments. And those payments go to support the park. And we were able to get some zoning benefits, as well as just the ability of being adjacent to the park and what that meant for the project. So we've gone both directions. We've been brought in into these public-private developments, and we've also brought these public-private developments to the governments. And again, surety of delivery is really not retreating and delivering what you promise is a important tool.
In terms of delivering, one of the things that I think is particularly interesting with you guys, and there's actually a lot of commonality between some of the developments you guys have done in New York, as well as one of the groups I work with here there's a development of the year that I can actually look out and oversee. And they did all sorts of earth work that they didn't need to necessarily do to create rolling hills that aren't always typical in Illinois, by the way, to try to give this idea of being located within a shire, because it's located in Lincolnshire. And in terms of that, why is consumer primacy and like developing these very, you know, tactile and visceral emotion reacting spaces important for you guys? And is there a certain tenant that you're targeting, or do you just think that consumer primacy is important for everyone?
I think every project is its own project. And I know that sounds silly to say when you say it out like that, but
no, it doesn't.
It really, you know, the design is specific to what you're trying to achieve on any given project. So Zero Irving had a very tech focused concept behind it. We knew that we wanted to deliver this digital skills training incubator, this workforce development center, and tech was the underlying kind of design ethos there. So the building is very techy. You know, we have things that you would not know unless you sat and spoke with us and the architect for a long time, but there's punch panels that are reminiscent of the old IBM punch cards. And so the design is something that it's got a lot of layers. And, you know, as you peel it off, you can really start to understand what we were trying to achieve. And there's something new every time you experience the space. We believe that in our residential projects and also our hospitality projects, the timelessness of the design is important. You know, we don't want to design projects that, you know, markets are a roller coaster, right? So you may not sell out everything within the next couple months. You may have a longer absorption. And we don't want to be redesigning, rebuilding apartments or experiences in order to move those units. We also want to design spaces that are universally appreciated. So the quality of our materials, the quality of our design can't be debated. You know, you might not like certain aspects of it, but overall, the idea is that it's a great design and it's a great delivery. We don't want people moving into our buildings expecting to rip out the kitchens or ripping out the bathrooms on day one. We can go back to some of the buildings that we've delivered over the last 25 years, and people still have the original finishes because they were timeless. They were designed in a way that they could be appreciated over the long term. They are durable. They're well-chosen materials for the specific use. And that all goes to creating the experience and really creating the draw. We don't believe in just doing what everyone else is doing. We also don't believe in just delivering the same cookie cutter development. Each project to us, it really becomes a passion project, and each one has its own merits that we need to focus on, and how the market will accept it, or what is in demand, or what may benefit a certain city over the long haul. So I think that tactile experience, that reception of the product is so important to our success, that it's not just the same product that you're seeing everywhere. It's not the same floor plan that you're seeing everywhere. It's really very specific to the site.
So one of the things that I think is fascinating about your developments is you've done most of them in New York, and now you're kind of moving into the Miami market. And I'm curious, we have New York and Miami are two of the larger listener groups of our podcast. It's definitely New York, Miami, LA, Chicago, Dallas, Houston, the triangle down there. I'm curious, what do you find is the biggest difference between the Miami market and the New York market?
So it's interesting that, you picked up on the New York work and the Miami work. And what I'd say is we've been everywhere in between along the way, and we've got interesting projects really across the country now. We're based here in New York. We have an office in Miami. We have an office in Denver. I also have a team in Houston, and we do a decent amount of work down in the Caribbean. So we like the diversity of the experiences, and it really goes to make everything a bit more rich. Like we're able to draw from the different offices and bring that input about problem solving or specific design issues really to the broader group and bring those solutions across the country. So here in New York, I think there's a lot of comparables between New York and Miami. We have not traditionally focused on Florida. We didn't follow the herd down there when in the post-COVID world. We didn't, over the years, we have not focused on ground up really traditionally in Florida. We've been very restrained in focusing in areas that we were more interested in, to be totally candid. We've done a great deal of work in Telluride, Colorado. We've done at this point about 220 acres of development in Colorado Springs in Colorado. We're currently developing a great project in Steamboat Springs, Colorado. So the Mountain West is very familiar to us as well. What drew us to Miami was this time with Link is Wynwood's special. And going back to...
It is. And yeah, for anyone who hasn't been there, it's a very unique development. So yeah, go ahead.
I appreciate that. It's going back to our concept that we're not just going to go everywhere and we're not just going to do the same thing that everyone else is doing. What we found in Wynwood was it really was, it was a real cultural based, it was a very unique neighborhood that was really reminiscent to us of what the meatpacking district was, 10, 15 years ago. And it has that cultural base, that arts and design appreciation that you don't find everywhere. And then when our partners brought the two sites that make up Link to our attention, we found that it was an amazing opportunity in an amazing neighborhood. It was two focal point pieces of property that created a true gateway from the west end of the region into Wynwood. We could design the first campus style office development in an urban setting that took advantage of the urban fabric that kind of weaves in and out of the development, both in interior and exterior spaces. We were able to work with a scale that we thought was appropriate in the neighborhood and deliver, like we talked about earlier, the diversity of floor plates, the complexity of design, the programming. We're working with many of the similar tenants and even, training organizations and all to bring the programming of Zero Irving. We keep referring to it as taking it on the road. It's a concept. Zero Irving, the underlying concepts behind Zero Irving are really applicable across the country. It wasn't magic. It was just putting together the right program for the site that took advantage of a location similar to what Link was in Miami, or Link is in Miami, and really created a draw to bring the people, the participants, and the tenants that are going to use that programming to the location. Yeah, I think Miami, there's still runway in Miami, especially in Wynwood. There's a lot of discussion of how these neighborhoods are going to grow with the Live Local law and some of these other planning agendas that are coming into play. But I think Wynwood in particular is really interesting, only because it's not built on that beach experience. It doesn't require any of those typical Miami forces to be what it is. It's really this great neighborhood that is culturally based, is really becoming a 24-hour community with the amount of residential that's coming on board, as well as the office space and the great nightlife. It's got all of the great underpinnings that we saw up here in Meatpacking District and Chelsea and beyond.
Look, I remember going down to Miami and seeing Wynwood when the development was just starting off. And I was talking to one of our friends who's passed on, who was a huge developer in the Chicago area, incredibly successful. And we both sat and said, look, this is either going to be the world's biggest flop or an absolute home run. We know what direction that went. I'm curious, when we're looking forward towards the future of the industry in general, there are certainly things that could be flops or home runs, but we always find that individuals who are in the arena tend to know, or at least have a much better idea of kind of where things are going. I'm curious, Spencer, where do you see office going in general and the industry going in general?
I think office is going to continue to evolve, but it's really going to be focused on what the experience is. It's never going to go back to office as just a box. I think these development as a whole is going to continue to get more and more diverse in how it's executed. Mixed use is going to become truly mixed use. It's not going to mean, you know, retail on the ground floor, some office above, and maybe some parking. I think those uses are going to continue to blend further and further, and how spaces are utilized is going to continue to evolve and blend. Office is certainly not dead, in my opinion. I spend a lot of time here in New York. I spend a lot of time in other cities around the country, and work from home has a shelf life. And sure, it's nice a day a week to, you know, work in a room that no one's jumping in and bothering you, but the complexity and the creativity of the work that's being produced is not there in a work from home environment. There are certainly jobs that can be done on your own and in a work from home environment, but there are many more jobs that really benefit from the collaboration and how those spaces work. The other thing that we're seeing evolve is, I think there's going to be further refinement of what was the move towards the open office. I think, you know, the hot desks are nice, but people also like to have their own space, and people like to know that they're coming in to kind of occupy their own space over and over. And I think that's going to be a bit of a shift, kind of like a smaller shift in the overall evolving office market back to some personal spaces. It's also, the open office environment is great for collaboration, but it's also, I think it's a hindrance to how we all spend a lot of time on our phones these days, and a lot of time speaking, and a lot of time kind of making noise. So that open office environment's not really conducive to that kind of work. So I think there's some hybrid design style that's going to come out of the evolution of what our office spaces look like. But certainly the office and the office development world is not dead. Office is not dead. There are great opportunities across this country to create great spaces for people to deliver creative work and progress going forward.
One of the things we love to talk about in terms of progress is progress that we've made in our own lives. And one of the things that we love to help out is there's a lot of younger listeners to this podcast. And I'm curious, let's step back in time to young Spencer. What would you give just, you know, 1 minute of quick advice about how you would handle starting off in your career?
I had the unique opportunity coming out of grad school to get involved in the family business early on. I was, this was 2005 before the economic collapse. And the world that I came into was a bustling development world. And I had the opportunity at the time coming out of grad school, I was submitting my portfolios to landscape architecture studios. And at the same time, I realized I had to evaluate. I had the opportunity to join the company and work my way up, but be involved in projects that it would take years to be involved in if I was going the straight landscape architecture route and at the level I would be involved in. And I chose to come join RAL, and it was the best decision I made. What I've learned over the years is that put yourself in experiences and opportunities where you can just listen. There's nothing wrong with listening, taking notes, whether they're actually written notes or mental notes, and learning as much as you can from the people that you're surrounded by. You don't always have to be the voice in the room. And that's something that I learned over time. You don't know everything, and there's a lot of people that know a lot more than you. So really take advantage of the people who are the experts around you. Ask questions when it's the right time and the right environment to do so. And really take it all in. I think that's the best piece of advice that I can give myself and give others. I still to this day really try to live by that and really try to benefit from the people that are around me. They are experts in everything that they do. And I would hope that people benefit from me as well. And I bring knowledge to others as well. But I think that's probably the best piece of advice I can give.
All right. And then the last question we have for you, which is the whole point to the podcast. And it's simply, we believe that the men and women who are in the arena know who to reach out to next. And so if you could recommend at least one person, and we won't let you get off the hook on this one, who should it be next?
I would say that in the world of real estate, if you could reach out to one person, I believe in starting local. So I think that the benefits of understanding your local planning or the local planning of where you want to end up or you think you want to end up, understanding what the growth patterns and what government thinks is going to happen. So that one person, if you're looking to build a career, my landscape architectural career started because I met a local park commissioner in a small park district on Long Island who overheard me talking to the person who was cutting my hair about landscape architecture. And she said, well, we're looking for a landscape architectural intern. Would you help us out? And I actually ended up getting a whole bunch of work from them early in my career. So my recommendation would be to start small and find someone local, whether that's someone in the planning department, someone in local government, like elected government, or even someone who's a stakeholder in a project that you've heard of or believe in your local area. I think that's a great first call to make, because that doesn't mean that you're focusing on that project. You're trying to learn more about how that person got involved or how or what they believe are the trends or what is local government looking to do. And I think that's a really good place to start. Sure, there are amazing visionaries in the real estate world, but they're also, I think they're also so broad-based. You know, you can talk to brokers, you can talk to developers, you can talk to operators, but on the ground, I think there's a lot to starting local and dealing with that kind of very tangible progress and what you can do.
We have a couple of people coming on from economic development for the end of the year in the greater Chicagoland and in the Illinois area. In terms of one last question, though, before we end, one of the questions that's important is if somebody wants to reach out to you, what's the best way that they can get in contact?
The best way to get in touch with me would be probably by email. I tend to see all my emails, and I tend to address I address them as either as I get them or kind of on a daily basis, or at least it's something tangible that I have in my hand.
And what's that email?
That email address is slevine@ralcompanies.com.
Brad, sir, thank you so much for hopping on the podcast today. We have to have you on in the future.
It was an absolute pleasure. I'd love that.
Thanks again to Spencer. We appreciate his insights. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a 5-star rating, and a review. Your comments, interactions, and subscriptions truly matter and help us continue to provide quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lanfear, The Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.